Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Kelly Jean Kelly, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Government advisors have suggested that people use a prescription version of fish oil to fight heart health problems. Currently, the drug Vascepa is approved for use in a fairly narrow group of patients. It is given to people who have very high levels of triglycerides, fats in the blood that are linked to heart disease. The drug maker Amarin wants the Food and Drug Administration to approve Vascepa for other problems linked to heart health. For example, doctors might prescribe the drug to patients with lower fat levels, but who are still at risk of heart problems and who take drugs for high cholesterol. A group of advisors to the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, all agreed to support the expansion based on a recent study result. The study suggested that the drug can reduce rates of life-threatening heart problems in high-risk patients. Dr. Jack Yanofsky is a member of the advisory group and a hormone specialist from the National Institutes of Health. He said there is no doubt this drug could benefit a large number of people. The advisory group noted several side effects of the drug. They include uneven heartbeat and bleeding inside the body. But the members agreed the good results outweighed those risks when a patient is under a doctor's care. The FDA is not required to follow the advice of the group. The agency is expected to make a decision by the end of this year. One member of the advisory group urged that the drug labeling should target patients who need it. The representative, Philip Posner, said, "I do not want to see this become what I call cardio candy." The FDA writes labels for drugs to guide doctors who prescribe them. The labels also are used by health insurance companies to decide which uses of drugs they are willing to pay for. A new label would make Vascepa the first fat-lowering drug approved by the FDA to reduce heart problems. The advisory group based its decision on a study that was supported by the manufacturer. The study found that Vascepa reduced the risk of heart attack, blocked arteries, and other problems by about 25% compared to an inactive treatment. Patients in the study had high triglyceride levels and other risks for heart problems, such as diabetes. However, the results came as a surprise because recent research has suggested that fish oil supplements did not improve heart health. millions of Americans take fish oil supplements, which they believe improve their health. Fish oils are rich in fats called omega-3 fatty acids, which scientists agree reduce triglycerides. But several studies have failed to show that this directly produces good results in patients. Amarin, however, says that its prescription drug is different from fish oil supplements. It would take 10 to 40 fish oil supplements to have the same effect as Vascepa, the company said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Tran is an experienced businesswoman. For more than 15 years, she has worked at THP Beverage Group, a private company that makes health drinks. Today, she is the deputy CEO, the second in company leadership. Tran is a professional success, but top female business leaders like Tran, are not so unusual in Vietnam. She says, when she goes to meetings, 3 or 4 out of 10 of the other people in the room are also women. A 2019 study supported Tran's observation. The report, called Women in Business, found that women hold 36% of top management positions in Vietnamese businesses. Only the Philippines had a higher rate, at 37.5%. In addition, Vietnam has the highest rates of women entrepreneurs in Asia-Pacific countries. Recent studies have found that women own between 25 and 30% of businesses in the country. Tran gives several reasons for the high number of women in business in Vietnam. People in Vietnam are starting to accept the idea of women working, she says, and women add value to companies. She says that her company found that women workers were more loyal than men and stayed longer in their jobs. They also give special attention to human relationships, she said. She adds that for herself, she feels lucky. Her parents started the business in 1994. Her father is the CEO. Tran notes that she began in an entry-level position and worked her way up. Tran says she sees younger Vietnamese women share her feelings of energy and interest in their work. They really like to try to prove and try to express themselves, she says. And between girls and boys in Vietnam, she believes, the girls are more aggressive. Thu Thu Hien is an expert on women-owned businesses. She leads the Women's Initiative for Startups and Entrepreneurship in Vietnam. Thu told the Vietnam News Agency in 2017 that women business leaders have certain strengths. Women-led businesses in the country are more likely to employ female workers, for example. They also spend more money on social insurance and pay a little bit more money in taxes to the government. Thu added that farming and tourism are promising areas for women-owned businesses in Vietnam. Vietnamese women have also succeeded in running large international businesses. The companies Vietjet, TH True Milk, and Vina Milk are all headed by women. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
For the first time, scientists have mapped the whole surface of Titan, the largest moon around Saturn. The map confirms existing data showing that Titan has many Earth-like qualities that might be able to support life. The data was collected by Cassini, a spacecraft operated by the U.S. space agency, NASA. The spacecraft studied Saturn and its moons from 2004 to 2017. Astronomers used images and radar measurements from Cassini to create the geological map of Titan. The map shows Titan as a mixture of flat plains, hills and mountains, wind-blown sand areas, valleys and lakes. The mapping operation is described in a report published in Nature Astronomy. Rosalie Lopez led the project. She is a planetary scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Lopez told the publication that the many similarities between Earth and Titan make the Saturn moon a great choice for continued exploration. Titan has an atmosphere like Earth. It has wind, it has rain, it has mountains, Lopez said. It's a really very interesting world, and one of the best places in the solar system to look for life. Titan is the only planet in our solar system besides Earth to have known bodies of liquid on its surface. But Titan's seas and lakes are filled with liquid methane rather than water. Methane, a gas, behaves as a liquid on Titan because the planet is extremely cold. At cold temperatures, methane goes through similar changes as rain on Earth. It falls to the surface across the planet to form rivers and lakes and can then evaporate to form clouds again. The map found that nearly two-thirds of Titan's surface is made up of flat plains, Nature reported. About 17% is covered in sandy hills shaped by the wind, mostly around the equator. Unlike Earth, Titan's sand is made up of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen. Around 14% of the surface is considered hilly or mountainous. Seas and lakes filled with liquid methane cover an estimated 1.5% of Titan. The liquid exists mainly closer to the planet's poles, while the equatorial areas remain drier. Ralph Lorenz is a planetary scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland. He told the publication one of Cassini's most interesting discoveries is that Titan is so diverse. Lorenz added, "It's almost like a completely different world, and this systematic mapping marshals that diversity." Rosalie Lopez says organic materials, those containing carbon, in Titan's atmosphere are important for the growth of living organisms. Organics are very important for the possibility of life on Titan, which many of us think likely would have evolved in the liquid water ocean under Titan's icy crust, she said. Scientists believe the mixing of organic material and liquid could have caused complex molecules to develop, or possibly life itself. The search for possible life on Titan will continue when NASA launches its Dragonfly mission to explore the planet in 2026. Dragonfly is a drone or pilotless aircraft. It is designed to capture images from above Titan as well as to land on the planet to collect data. Dragonfly is not expected to arrive at Titan until 2034. But when it does, Lopez and her team will be excitedly awaiting its findings. It is not only scientifically important, but also really cool, a drone flying around on Titan, she said. It will be really exciting. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Just before sunrise on April 12, 1861, the first shot was fired in the American Civil War. A heavy mortar roared, sending a shell high over the harbor at Charleston, South Carolina. The shell dropped and exploded above Fort Sumter, a United States military base on an island in the harbor. The explosion was a signal for all Confederate guns surrounding the fort to open fire. Shell after shell smashed into the fort. The booming of the cannons woke the people of Charleston. They rushed to the harbor and cheered as the bursting shells lighted the dark sky. Jack Moyles and Stuart Spencer tell about the attack on Fort Sumter.
Confederate leaders ordered the attack after President Abraham Lincoln refused to withdraw the small force of American soldiers at Sumter. Food supplies at the fort were very low, and Southerners expected hunger would force the soldiers to leave. But Lincoln announced he was sending a ship to Fort Sumter with food. Confederate President Jefferson Davis ordered his commander in Charleston, General Beauregard, to destroy the fort before the food could arrive.
The attack started from Fort Johnson, across the harbor from Sumter. A Virginia congressman, Roger Pryor, was visiting Fort Johnson when the order to fire was given. The fort's commander asked Pryor if he would like the honor of firing the mortar that would begin the attack. No, answered Pryor, and his voice shook. I cannot fire the first gun of the war. But others could, and the attack began.
At Fort Sumter, Major Robert Anderson and his men waited 3 hours before firing back at the Confederate guns. Anderson could not use his most powerful cannons. They were in the open, at the top of the fort, where there was no protection for the gunners. Too many of his small force would be lost if he tried to fire these guns. So Anderson had his men fire the smaller cannon from better protected positions. These, however, did not do much damage to the Confederate guns.
The shelling continued all day. A big cloud of smoke rose high in the air over Fort Sumter. The smoke was seen by United States Navy ships a few miles outside Charleston Harbor. They had come with the ship bringing food for the men at Sumter. There were soldiers on these ships, but they could not reach the fort to help Major Anderson. Confederate boats blocked the entrance to the harbor, and Confederate guns could destroy any ship that tried to enter. The commander of the naval force, Captain Fox, had hoped to move the soldiers to Sumter in small boats, but the sea was so rough that the small boats could not be used. Fox could only watch and hope for calmer seas.
Confederate shells continued to smash into Sumter throughout the night and into the morning of the second day. The fires at Fort Sumter burned higher, and smoke filled the rooms where soldiers still tried to fire their cannons. About noon, three men arrived at the fort in a small boat. One of them was Lewis Wigfall, a former United States senator from Texas, now a Confederate officer. He asked to see Major Anderson. "I come from General Beauregard," he said. "It is time to put a stop to this, sir. The flames are raging all around you, and you have defended your flag bravely. Will you leave, sir?" Wigfall asked.
Major Anderson was ready to stop fighting. His men had done all that could be expected of them. They had fought well against a much stronger enemy. Anderson said he would surrender if he and his men could leave with honor. Wigfall agreed. He told Anderson to lower his flag and the firing would stop. Down came the United States flag, and up went the white flag of surrender. The battle of Fort Sumter was over. More than 4,000 shells had been fired during the 33 hours of fighting, but no one on either side was killed. One United States soldier, however, was killed the next day when a cannon exploded as Anderson's men prepared to leave the fort.
The news of Anderson's surrender reached Washington late Saturday, April 13th. President Lincoln and his cabinet met the next day and wrote a declaration that the president would announce on Monday. In it, Lincoln said powerful forces had seized control in 7 states of the South. He said these forces were too strong to be stopped by courts or policemen. Lincoln said troops were needed. He requested that the states send him 75,000 soldiers. He said these men would be used to get control of forts and other federal property seized from the Union.
Lincoln knew he had the support of his own party. He also wanted Northern Democrats to give him full support. So, Sunday evening, a Republican congressman visited the top Democrat of the North, Senator Stephen Douglas. The congressman urged Douglas to go to the White House and tell Lincoln that he would do all he could to help put down the rebellion in the South. At first, Douglas refused. He said Lincoln had removed Democrats, friends of his, from government jobs, and had given the jobs to Republicans. Douglas said he didn't like this. Anyway, he said, Lincoln probably did not want his advice. The congressman, George Ashman, urged Douglas to forget party politics. He said Lincoln and the country needed the senator's help. Douglas finally agreed to talk with Lincoln. He and Ashman went immediately to the White House.
Lincoln welcomed his old political opponent. He explained his plans and read to Douglas the declaration he would announce the next day. Douglas said he agreed with every word of it, except, he said, 75,000 soldiers would not be enough. Remembering his problems with Southern extremists, he urged Lincoln to ask for 200,000 men. He told the president, "You do not know the dishonest purposes of those men as well as I do." Lincoln and Douglas talked for 2 hours. Then the senator gave a statement for the newspapers. He said he still opposed the administration on political questions, but, he said, he completely supported Lincoln's efforts to protect the Union. Douglas was to live for only a few more months. He spent this time working for the Union. He traveled through the states of the Northwest, making many speeches. Douglas urged Democrats everywhere to support the Republican government. He told them, "There can be no neutrals in this war, only patriots or traitors."
Throughout the North, thousands of men rushed to answer Lincoln's call for troops. Within 2 days, a military group from Boston left for Washington. Other groups formed quickly in northern cities and began training for war. Lincoln received a different answer, however, from the border states between North and South. Virginia's governor said he would not send troops to help the North get control of the South. North Carolina's governor said the request violated the Constitution. He would have no part of it. Tennessee said it would not send one man to help force Southern states back into the Union. But it said it would send 50,000 troops to defend Southern rights. Lincoln got the same answer from the governors of Kentucky, Arkansas, and Missouri. For several days, it seemed that all these states would secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
Lincoln worried most about Virginia, the powerful state just across the Potomac River from Washington. A secession convention already was meeting at the state capital. On April 17th, the convention voted to take Virginia out of the Union. Virginia's vote to secede forced an American Army officer to make a most difficult decision. The officer was Colonel Robert E. Lee, a citizen of Virginia. The Army's top commander, General Winfield Scott, had called Lee to Washington. Scott believed Lee was the best officer in the Army. Lincoln agreed. He asked Lee to take General Scott's job to become the Army chief. Lee was offered the job on the same day that Virginia left the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.